This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
The link we sent is...
We're live now. So do you, we can... I'll post it while you carry on, yeah? Okay. Bismillah, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salam, wa rasulillah. Today, we are going to be speaking about Muslim slaves in America, that they were Muslims who were kidnapped, who were enslaved from Africa, and places like West Africa in particular, and taken across to America. And their struggles, their life is something which is sadly pretty much lost in history. So this is something that inshallah we want to highlight, and this will be a source of inspiration for many, many people. So Adnan, as an introduction to this topic, please get us started.
Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, thank you so much for being patient with us. We had some technical glitches. Now we are back on course. And I thank you, Brother Sabul, for inviting me to address this important topic, often neglected and understudied.
Could you take out the headphones? Maybe that's going to be easier.
You hear me now?
Yeah, much better.
Okay, so this is better then. So often... very much underappreciated topic and understudied. And the topic is Muslims in America in general, Muslims in America, and African Muslims in particular in America. We are dealing with African Muslims today in particular, Muslims who came from Africa, right? If you look at Muslims in America, that's a very wide history that deals with a lot of people from different places coming to America in different times. And it starts with the very discovery of America as far as the Europeans are concerned. We know Christopher Columbus landed on America or at America, right, in 1492. And thenceforth, a lot of Muslims from Islamic Spain, who were later on called Moriscos, also came to the Americas. And there are histories written about them. So the Muslim existence in America is as early as America itself, okay? Or the discovery of America itself. But today we are going to talk about the Atlantic slave trade, which caused hundreds of thousands of Muslims to be kidnapped from Africa, and they were taken across the Atlantic Ocean to the Americas. When I say the Americas, I mean North America, Central America, and South America. So all of these regions were basically filled with Muslims who came from predominantly West Africa. Now the question is, what were these African Muslims doing in America? How did they end up there? They were actually kidnapped, as I stated earlier. Atlantic slave trade was basically one of the most barbaric episodes in human history. Okay, it started somewhere around in the mid 15th century, let's say 1450s, and it continued for another 400 years until 1850s, until it was completely abolished and outlawed and made illegal by Western nations that were indulging in it for 400 years. So there were Dutch merchants, there were Portuguese merchants or merchant ships. There was a lot of mercantile activity throughout the Atlantic Ocean. And after the discovery of Americas, there was labor needed to basically take advantage of the land that was newly discovered. The Native Americans proved to be poor labor, according to the settlers at the time. So they needed stocky, big men who are willing to work, and they will be made to work. So Africans came to mind to some of these European adventurers. So they found a solution to it. So what they did was, they would come from Europe to West Africa. They would buy a slave in large numbers. They would pack ships with these slaves, right? Slaves were very often victims of wars. They had become captives of wars, or sometimes they were simply kidnapped from their homes. So because slave trade started, the Europeans became very interested in slave trade, in buying slaves. Some of the Africans, they started to feed this demand of slaves by kidnapping their African brothers and sisters. So this is a reality that cannot be denied, although some people do try to deny this. But at the end of the day, it were the Europeans who were feeding this slave trade. So a lot of these people were kidnapped throughout these four centuries I mentioned, from 1450s to 1850s, right? And hundreds of thousands of people. There are estimates that minimum at least 12 million people were taken from Africa within these four centuries. And at least a million of them, at least a million of those 12 million people were Muslims. Okay, so the numbers, of course, are conservative. Numbers may be as high as 100 million people, 100 million humans kidnapped, bought as slaves by the Europeans predominantly, and shipped across the Atlantic Ocean to the Americas and put into slavery in North America, in Central America, and in South America, right? So this is a summary. This is an introduction to the problem we are going to be talking about today. The question that how did the Muslims, African Muslims, end up in the Americas in the first place? So this is the answer. Atlantic slave trade. There was a bloody triangle. Bloody triangle is very well known to those who study the history of Atlantic slave trade. Basically, what was this triangle? Ships would start their journey from Liverpool. They would come to West Africa. And they would sell commodities to Africans, and in return, they would buy slaves in large numbers, in thousands, and they would pack their ships with these slaves, sometimes putting them in spaces as large as 6 by 2, if not 6 by 3. 6 feet by 2 feet, basically as much space as needed for a human being to fit in. So they would be lying in this position in chains, often being injured by shackles put on them, often being fed in that position, often even relieving themselves in that position. So the stench would be completely unbearable because these humans would be kept in this position for weeks before they would be let out to go on the deck and relax their muscles for a while, and they would be washed with seawater, and they would be put back into the dungeon, into the basement of ships. So the picture is absolutely horrendous. When you actually read histories, you don't understand how humans can do this to other humans, right? And this was happening for 400 years. People talk about the Holocaust. People talk about the massacres and the genocides that took place in the 20th century and the 21st century. But people often forget one of the greatest genocides in human history. I repeat, one of the greatest genocides, one of the most cruel and barbaric genocides in human history, was called the Atlantic slave trade, completely funded, facilitated, and run by European powers. In particular, European colonial powers, Portuguese, the British, the Dutch, the French, were all at it. They were buying slaves from West Africa, they called these slaves human cargo. They called them cargo. They were cargo. They would be insured, and they would be dumped into the sea very often, basically for claiming insurance, right? They would be insured, and when some of these slaves got sick or they got injured, their bones got broken because of the shackles they were in, they would be thrown into the sea, and then these merchants would claim insurance on the part of these slaves. So Bloody Triangle was basically ships would start from Liverpool. They would come to West African countries like Sierra Leone, Ghana, or Guinea, for example, Senegal. These were the countries they were buying slaves from predominantly. So they would buy slaves and they would sell commodities brought from Britain. And then these slaves would be shipped across the Atlantic. These slaves then would be sold to American buyers who would be willing to pay handsome money for these stocky big men coming, or women, of course, coming from West Africa, healthy people, and they would be put to plantations and other work, basically into agriculture. And a lot of these slaves were killed within 4 years. Okay, the average life of these slaves would be 4 years. They would die within 4 years, worked to death in sugar plantations, because the workload was very, very, very hot. So this is a summary of what was happening in these 400 years, from 1450s to 1850s. Now, throughout this period, many Muslim Africans, some of them scholars, learned men, people who had studied classical texts of Islam in proper institutions, some of them even royalty, princes were kidnapped as they were captured in wars between African states and African principalities. They would be captured and then they would be sold in spite of the status within Africa. They would be sold to these European slavers. And there are a few examples we will be discussing in due course. So at least a million of these, if the number is 12 million, if it's not 100 million, because some scholars, they claim the number is anywhere between 12 million human beings to 100 million human beings. The numbers can be anywhere between 12 million to 100 million human beings. Okay. And at least 10% of these slaves, at least if not more, some say even 30%, right? At least 10% of these slaves or people who were captured from Africa, kidnapped from Africa, they were Muslims, practicing Muslims. And we find the evidence in whatever remains in the form of their clothing, the form of their writings, their manuscripts they have left behind, and they can be found in American museums, in private collections, and some of the museums even in South America and Central America. So one book we strongly recommend for everyone before we begin, this is a book we strongly recommend for everyone to read. Those of you watching this live feed, please go and buy this book or get your hands on this book. This is the book that documents the history I am narrating in a very, very short video. What is the book, Brother Sabur? Can you show it to our viewers? Okay, this is the book. The book is titled Servants of Allah. Servants of Allah. And we will talk about the man who is depicted on the cover there. Okay. His name is Job Ben Solomon. And the author of this book is Sylvain E. Dioff. So if you bring the book closer, Brother Sabur, so the people can actually read the name of the author. Okay. Sylvain E. Dioff is an author from America, from the US. She has written this excellent, amazing book titled Servants of Allah, and she documents the history of Muslim slaves who were kidnapped from Africa and taken across the Atlantic. Let's start with the person who is depicted on the cover there. The most famous or the most recognized face of Islam in America, or one of the most recognized faces of Islam in America. This man was Ayyub bin Sulaiman Diallo. Okay, Ayyub bin Sulaiman Diallo, or also known as Job Ben Solomon. Job Ben Solomon in the American history. Okay, he was from Senegal, current day Senegal, and he was a scholar of Islam. He was a young man kidnapped in early 1730s, and taken across the Atlantic and sold into slavery. When he was caught and sold into slavery, his buyer was a certain Captain Pike. And this Captain Pike was told by Suleiman, or Ayyub bin Suleiman, that his father can pay handsome money for this. Basically, Ayyub Suleiman Diallo made the most of his, made the most of his literacy. He was a literate man. He was a very, very literate man. He was a learned man. He was a prince. He was given a high quality of education by his father, who happened to be a king of his principality. And Ayyub bin Suleiman was caught by some of his adversaries, and he was sold to this captain called Stephen Pike, okay, who was the captain of a ship called Arabella. Okay, so Diallo offered Pike money in return for his freedom. Diallo told Pike, Captain Pike, that my father can pay handsomely for my freedom. So Pike agreed, and Suleiman sent a messenger to his father to pay the money. But by the time they came back to free him, Arabella had already left the port, right? So as a consequence, Ayub bin Suleiman was sold to an American master, and then later on he wrote a letter in Arabic to his father from America, from Maryland. He was sold in to a plantation in current day Maryland in America. He wrote this letter to his father asking him to release him or free him from this slavery, and the letter was given to another slave trader so that the letter can come to Captain Pike, who can take the letter back to Senegal and somehow get the letter to the father of Suleiman bin Ayub. But the letter never made it to, unfortunately, Africa, but it made to London. It made it to London. So in London, when the letter was discovered, it was read, and people who read the letter became very intrigued. And cut the long story short, Ayub bin Suleiman was freed from his slavery from these scholars in London who had come to read his letter, and they were impressed by his Arabic skills, and they knew this is not just a common slave. He's a learned man, he's a scholar. And Ayub bin Suleiman was bought from his owner or his master in America, and he was brought to London. Ayub lived in London for nearly 2 to 3 years, and he was frequenting the streets of London. He was a celebrity, a known celebrity in London. He met the royal family. He spent time with them, and he even helped Sir Hans Sloane. Sir Hans Sloane, whose private collection was the foundation of the British Museum, the British Library, and the Natural History Museum. Suleiman helped him translate some of the Arabic documents in his possessions. Suleiman bin Ayub became a celebrity overnight in London, and he wrote 3 copies of the Quran from memory while he was in London. So if you look at his picture again on the cover of the book, Suleiman bin Ayub, you see a copy of the Quran in his neck. You can see a copy hanging from his neck. He was wearing this copy of the Quran he had written in his own hand from memory. So from his memory, Suleiman bin Ayub, having been sold into slavery, then freed by some scholars in London and brought to London, and then was put to translating some Arabic manuscripts in the British Library collection, and later on freed, of course, and he was free to go back to his home. In 1734, he did return and found nothing much left behind. Unfortunately, his father was killed in war, he was told, and his wife was missing. His entire family was displaced. And these were chaotic times in Africa at the time, primarily because of this evil slave trade. It was causing a lot of disturbance within West African territory, because a lot of these raids were taking place. A lot of people were fighting wars to acquire slaves, to accumulate a huge number of slaves so that they can sell it and become rich. So this is a brief story of Suleiman bin Ayub. I haven't done justice to his history. There is a book that has been published by Oxford University Press. It is titled The Fortunate Slave. The book is titled The Fortunate Slave. It is a biography of Suleiman bin Ayub. Please get your hands on that book, and you can get more details about Suleiman and his whereabouts in the UK, in London. And when he was walking around the streets of London wearing his turban and Islamic attire, and he became a celebrity. So people who think that Muslims just turned up in the Americas in the 60s and the 70s, and likewise in the British Isles, they are mistaken. Muslims have had a very positive long-term presence on the British political, literary, an intellectual landscape. I repeat, the Muslims have had a very, very long lasting legacy in Britain when it comes to literature, literacy, and other contributions, right? And likewise in America. As soon as America was discovered, the Muslims were there from the very, very beginning, in the very foundations of the American civilization. And I am planning a lecture in the future where I will talk about Islam and America, just like I have talked about Islam and Britain. You can find this lecture on my YouTube channel. I will be doing another lecture, Islam and America, and I will be talking about the slaves and how they made a difference. So there are other examples, Brother Sabur. While I'm going on, do you want to say something? Yeah. Do you want to ask something? Do you want to clarify something?
But I did want to just highlight that I have the same reaction as many people in the audience, which is just that of sheer astonishment at, a West African prince enslaved who goes on to the UK and actually then mingles with the higher aspects of society. And, this is something unbelievable when you think about it. This is what the 18th century, right? Yeah. And he wrote the Quran from memory three times. So, this is really incredible. And one of the things I just wanted to highlight is for many of our American brothers, for many of the people in the black community, we know that they convert to Islam in large numbers compared to other people in America. And this is something which will be a source of inspiration for them, that their blood is probably from places in Africa that were predominantly Muslim. This is also something which I just want to ask you, that, from the slavery perspective, we want to cover this topic again, but I did want to ask you a very basic question about, they treated slaves as pure human cargo. So it was not just about, we're going to keep them in this particular way, this one we're going to get insurance off because his arm's broken. But West Africans are known, you've traveled all over Africa for the last decade, so maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but from my understanding, West Africa, which is predominantly Muslim, is the place with the largest body, the people with the largest frames, with the biggest heights. So for example, Senegal, Nigeria, we went to Nigeria together, the people were huge, right? So the women and the men are actually tall compared to, say, Malawi or other parts. So is that why they were targeted? They were targeting that area because of the size of the people there?
Possibly. There's no doubt that the West Africans who were taken across the Atlantic were very much desired because of their frames, because of their physiology, right? They were physically huge. Even if you look at West Africans today, like Fulani people, the Mandingo people, for example, they were very, very much, they were very, very much desired in America, because these sugar plantations, they required strong men to work through those hard circumstances and conditions. And that's why, imagine a 20 to 25 years old Mandingo man, maybe 6.5 feet tall, very tough guy, a tough looking, big muscle person. He would be worked to death within 4 years. What could he be possibly doing for him to die within 4 years is the question, right? So the average was about, the lifespan of these slaves was about 4 years. So they would have to be worked to death, and their money would have to be worked basically out of them within these 4 years. So this is how these slave traders and sugar plantation owners, they measured their value. The stronger the person, the stronger the slave, the higher the value. This is why when they would see that some of them got injured en route to America, some of them got injured because of shackles, because of the space they were put in, 6x2, and obviously because of that they got body sores, because they were crammed in very, very small spaces, and they were put on wood. They weren't put on mattresses or some soft surface. Rather, they would be lying on wooden planks, right? And that would cause body sores, and their body sores would be infected. And because of that, a lot of them got ill, and they would be thrown into the sea. There are books written on this topic, by the way, Atlantic Slavery. Hugh Thomas is a very standard book you can read. The author called Hugh Thomas, he has written a book titled The Atlantic Slave Trade. Read it, and you will see some of the reality. And there's another one I hold here, The Slavery Reader, published by the Routledge Press. It's a collection of articles, excellent articles on Atlantic slave trade. So you must study this topic to understand how cruel humans can become due to greed and their aspirations, albeit misplaced and very evil aspirations, but they can inflict extreme harm to other humans if they don't follow any set moral value, if they don't, if their belief in God is not right, right? Because a lot of these people were Christians. All of these people were taking all these, I'm not saying Christianity causes this, but somehow Christianity did not prevent this catastrophe of 400 years. This went on for 400 years. And most of the people involved were Christians, right? Of course, even abolition, the abolition of slave trade was also, you know, promoted by Christians later on. People like William Wilberforce and John Newton, who himself was a slaver once upon a time, and he made repentance. He repented and even wrote a poem titled Amazing Grace. Amazing Grace is his poem. John Newton, who basically repented and he became an abolitionist. So there are both sides. But unfortunately, for 400 years, it is unbelievable how these catastrophes and cruelties went on. Moving on to some other characters we want to talk about very quickly. Muslims, African Muslims in America. There was another very interesting character called Umar bin Said, right? Yes. Born in Senegal. If you put his name in Google, you will see his pictures, the actual photographs, right? He was born in Senegal in 1770, and he was a well-known character. In the summer of 1863, newspapers in North Carolina announced the death of Umar bin Suleiman. He was known as Uncle Murio, right? And he was a practicing Muslim. He was struggling to practice his faith, even though he was thought to have converted to Christianity, but he didn't convert to Christianity. He was given a Bible. And some of these Muslim slaves to navigate through the difficult circumstances they were facing, they pretended to become Christians. They pretended, right? They basically gave an impression to their masters and the owners that, okay, they are inclined to Christianity to make their lives easy. So Umar bin Said is known for something similar. He was given a Bible. His personal Bible is still preserved. It is in a collection in America. And on the very first page of the Bible, there are salawat upon the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Now, can you imagine a Christian reading a Bible, right, and writing salawat upon the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam? So what he was trying to say is that, because those people couldn't read Arabic, he was writing in Arabic inside his Bible, salawat upon the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So he was hiding his Muslim faith, okay, from these Christian counterparts, so that he's not persecuted or brutalized by his master and his neighbors. So there are many more examples like that. I mean, generally speaking, there are so many testimonies so many accounts of African Muslims trying to survive as Muslims in these extremely hostile circumstances, and how they managed to do that. Sylviane Adioff gives absolutely fascinating details and evidence in her book in this regard. She documents a lot of examples where Muslims were basically trying to pray. There are testimonies. There was basically a Muslim called Bilali from Guinea. His name was Bilali, right? And he was from Guinea. And, you know, in America, he wrote a document that came from the one of the classical works from the 11th century. And that document was originally authored by a Tunisian scholar of Islam, Ibn Abu Zayd al-Qayrawani. So Bilali, in the US, wrote a 13-page document, part of a work by the 10th century Tunisian Ibn Abu Zayd al-Qayrawani. Okay, it was written on paper, produced in Italy for the North African market, which raises intriguing questions as to how he acquired it. It is possible that Bilali kept it with him, he brought it with him, or he might have written it himself. But this was a Muslim from Guinea who was copying classical works, classical Islamic works that are only known by scholars. This is not a layman. This is a scholar in America writing a classical text in Islam on 13 pages, right? And the text comes from the 10th century from a scholar from Tunisia, Ibn Abu Zayd al-Qayrawani. This is an example, right? Also, there are other examples of Muslims fasting. And these testimonies were basically put down by other slaves, Christian slaves, who were observing the Muslims do all of this, right? There was another very famous slave who was walking the streets of Washington, D.C. His name was Yaro Mahmud. Yaro Mahmud, or possibly Yaro Mahmud, another highly visible Muslim, was taken from Guinea in 1752 when he was about 16 years old. After 44 years of slavery, he was freed and bought a house in Washington, D.C. Mahmud was a kind of celebrity who was often seen and heard in the streets singing praise of God and conversing with him, right? Talking to God, maybe making dua to Allah. Okay, often heard loud in the streets of Washington, D.C. This is Yaro Mahmud, who was basically taken from Guinea in 1752, right? As a 16 years old. And Islam never left him. This is a 16 years old who was kidnapped when he was 16. He did not abandon Islam despite all the preaching of Christianity, all the Christian preachers, masters and missionaries and clergy and going to churches and all of that did not convert him to Christianity. Kidnapped as a 16 years old child, still remained Muslim until his death. In fact, there are reports about him that he used to say, "Do not drink and do not eat hog." Basically, he would tell people in Washington where he was living that don't drink alcohol is bad and do not eat hog. Hog is pig, swine meat. So in other words, he was even doing dawah in his little capacity. So Yaro Mahmud was doing dawah in his little capacity in those extreme circumstances. This is the legacy of Afro-Americans. This is what Afro-Americans need to look up to. This is what they need to dig deeper. This is what they need to realize. This is why they need to realize why they are coming to Islam in such large numbers. It is part of the DNA. Islam was the original religion. Many of them, not all of course, hundreds of thousands of your ancestors were African Muslims. So this dhikr you are making today, having converted to Islam or having reverted to Islam rather, is not just from a vacuum. It is possibly the du'as of your ancestors, the ones you descend from. They were making du'a, "Oh Allah, protect our faith, our iman in these extreme hostile conditions and make our children Muslims. Make our children Muslims." I am pretty sure some of these people made these du'as, and that's why so many Afro-Americans are coming to Islam in droves, in droves. You walk through the streets of New York, you walk through the streets of other American cities, you will see black Africans, Afro-Americans accepting Islam in large numbers. This is not just accidental, my brothers and sisters. This is the legacy of your predecessors, your ancestors, who were kidnapped in large numbers from Africa and brought to America against their wishes, against their desires. And despite all that, they were still holding on to Islam. There's another example of a 14 years old who was picked up from Africa, a 14 years old child. Okay, who was this? This is Saleh Bilali. Okay, for example, abducted in Mali when he was about 14. 60 years later, he was still a strict Muslim, abstaining from liquors and keeping various fasts, particularly that of Ramadan, wrote his owner, James Hamilton Cooper. So his owner, Saleh Bilali's owner, okay, there was a man called African man taken from Mali. His name was Saleh Bilali, taken as a 14 years old child. This is what I want you to understand, the veracity of these people. They love for Islam despite all the extraordinary odds they were facing against them, right? Look at his love for Islam. This man was taken as a 14 years old. 60 years later, his master is writing, the one who owns him in America, he's writing. His name is James Hamilton Cooper. He writes that he is still a strict Muslim, abstaining from liquor and fasting the month of Ramadan. Taken as a 14 years old. This is the legacy of Afro-Americans. This is the history of Afro-Americans. And by the way, Muslim slaves were singled out or separated from the rest of the African slaves. You know why? Because of the education Muslims had received in West Africa. This was a very vibrant period in West Africa as far as the spread of Islam is concerned. A lot of these people, because of being Muslims, they were taught how to read and write. And they went to seminaries, they went to madaris, they went to universities in some cases. In the case of Bilali from Guinea, who wrote a 10th century text from memory, amazingly, what does this tell you? He's writing from memory, not Quran, because Quran was written by many, many slaves. The Quran, Ayub bin Suleiman was one example, but the Quran was written by many, many slaves from memory. Okay, and later scholars are still surprised as to how many Qurans, I mean, how so many Qurans ended up in America, because they were not allowed to carry books. They were naked. Most of these slaves were completely naked when they were taken. So they had written these Qurans from their memories in America while they were slaves.
Allah.
So my brothers and sisters, this is what we have discussed with you today. Yeah, they're fasting, they're abstaining from pig meat, they're abstaining from liquor, their resistance to Christianity and other evil influences they came across in America. Okay, and all those things, basically, you know, this is fascinating. This is amazing. This story needs to be told louder and louder. Muslims need to know about this, right? So we leave it here because we don't want to exhaust you with details. But what we want you to do is we will basically put a link to the book so that you don't struggle finding it. And we will put an article written by the same author, Sylviane Adioff, in Al Jazeera, or for the Al Jazeera website. She has written an article and she has given these brief details. Those of you who don't have the time to read the entire book, I highly recommend that you read this article. It gives you a good summary of some of the experiences. But I very, very strongly recommend the book to you. Servants of Allah by Sylviane Adioff. Okay. And we will give you the link to the article as well. And you can read both, inshallah. I think we will stop there, Brother Sabur.
Definitely. So, Jazakallah khair, Adnan bhai, for that very touching, in fact. There was one point where, you know, I got very emotional. You said, you know, he wrote Salam upon the Prophet, you know, in the Bible. So, you know, for everybody watching, wherever you are in the world, alhamdulillah, I'm very happy to see one of the sisters was actually saying that she's a Fulani herself and she's from West Africa. And there's people from all over speaking about this. So I just want you to give one quick message, which
is... If I'm not mistaken, Ayub bin Suleiman was Fulani. Ayub bin Suleiman was Fulani. So a lot of Fulanis and Mandingos and other tribes and other West Africans, generally West Africans, they were taken, right? And before I go, very quickly, I want to remind everyone, Google Umar bin Said and read his biography, possibly on Wikipedia. You'll find plenty of information there. Also Google Yaro Mahmood. Yaro Mahmood is Yarrow. Mahmood is Mamout. Google his name, you will find his biography. And then also Google Job Ben Solomon. Job Ben Solomon or Ayub bin Suleiman Diallo. Diallo. You will see these three biographies and they will fascinate you. And more are found in the book, inshallah. Yeah.
And here you have a picture of Umar bin Said. And this is...
It is writing.
This is a surah of the Quran he wrote by memory.
Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.
Absolutely. But now, Jazakallah khair for your precious time. We're going to be live again next week with a different topic related to this. We want to revisit this from a different angle. But the message to everybody that's watching this right now, inshallah, is that all of us as Muslims, we need to give dawah, especially to the black communities within the Western world. And also, many of the Muslims which are in Africa, they should be inspired by this to actually give dawah. Because if you look, north is Muslim, central is mixed, and then south is Christian. And even some of the Muslims in the middle have converted, sadly. So until next time, please keep in mind, it is our duty to convey the message of Islam.
Before we end, Brother Sabur, you know, these African Muslim slaves, they were still doing dawah in America, even though they were facing extraordinary odds. Wallahi de dawah, the details, the evidence you will find in the book written by Sylviane Adioff. And there was actually a scholar among them who basically, there was a rebellion. It's called Bahia Rebellion. Bahia Rebellion is B-H-A-I, Bahia Rebellion, something like that is called. Okay, and one of the scholars, he wrote a long text, 50 pages text, to encourage people to remain Muslim and don't abandon Islam for whatever they are offered in return, and remain Muslim and continue as Muslims. So this kind of dawah, Allahu Akbar, in these extreme circumstances, when they're being killed, brutalized, lashed, cut into pieces, thrown into the sea, and being worked to death in plantations, they are facing extraordinary odds, and some of the cruelest masters, and they're still doing dawah, still holding on to Islam, praying, reading the Quran, writing Quran, and keeping up with the dhikr and azkar, Allahu Akbar. These people were just, you know, wallahi, I can't emphasize this enough, that we need to read about them. We need to read about them, inshallah.
Absolutely, absolutely. So until next time, this is something that we all need to action. And inshallah, in the future, we're going to be covering some of the things we described in more detail. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam.